Okay, I think we're going to go ahead and start now. Thank you for coming to our session. This is the Ordained Women panel. We're each going to be talking. We've kind of picked our bunch of different topics, so we're going to cover a smattering of things to do with ordained women. We're just going to go down the row. We're going to hear from Lori Stromberg first, then we'll hear from Deborah Jensen and Amy Cartwright, and then myself. I'm Nancy Ross. Did I say something wrong? I'm sorry. And then Chelsea Shieldstrayer. Okay. And before I say something else wrong, we're just going to turn the time over to Lori. Okay.
So that I can say a bunch of things wrong. Okay. Mine, by the way, will be the boring presentation. I'm just warning you now, so get ready to stretch afterwards. So I'm going to do a discussion about changing notions about priesthood that have occurred in the last couple of years as a result, I think, of ordained women. So here I go. Can you hear me? Right in front, like that? Okay, then I'm going to have to put this out like this. Is that okay? Okay. After over 30 years of speaking and writing about women and ordination with a handful of others, I'm thrilled that the discussion has finally gone viral. I don't think there's any question that recent feminist initiatives and ordained women's actions, including the ever-expanding number of people willing to go public and submit the "I'm a Mormon and I believe women should be ordained" profiles that I believe are foundational to the Ordained Women website, have been a major catalyst for the recent explosion of interest in women and priesthood in Mormonism. My remarks... Do most of you agree with me on that? Yeah. Okay. My remarks today are decidedly impressionistic. What I'd like to discuss are some of the shifts that I've noted in recent discussions of priesthood, particularly as it relates to women. I plan to focus mostly on official church discourse, particularly the writings of President Linda K. Burton, Sister Sherry Dew, and Elders Dallin Oaks, Russell Ballard, and Neil Anderson. But first, a little background. The question of women's ordination had to enter the realm of the thinkable before it could enter the realm of the possible. What we conceptualized and called for as Mormon feminists had to be clear and specific and actionable. As Mormon feminists, how could we expect church leaders, however open or concerned about women's issues, to respond to nebulous calls for a more equitable church, while recognizing and supporting the many lists of institutional changes that could make Mormonism more inclusive? For many of us, the structural inequity was such that anything less than ordination seemed insufficient. By January of 2013, when we came together to form Ordained Women, the seeds for a growing discussion on the topic of women's ordination already had been planted. As I noted, a handful of us, including and primarily Nadine Hansen and Margaret Toscano, had written about women's ordination over the last 30 years. The All Are Like Unto God document. How many here are familiar with the All Are Like Unto God document? Okay, there's still some of you who aren't. Okay. The All Are Like Unto God document, calling on general church leaders to thoughtfully consider and earnestly pray about the question of women's ordination and the integration of women into the decision-making structure of the church, had been mailed the previous September to church leaders, and several hundred women and men had already signed in support of it. Mormon blogs such as Exponent, Times and Seasons, Patheos, and I can never pronounce this, Zehefalud's daughters, had begun seriously to address the issue. So we'd already seen some writing on the internet about this. How then does current official church discourse on women and priesthood reflect this increased interest, and how has it evolved over the last couple of years in ways that might facilitate the eventual ordination of women? Okay, now the boring part. First and foremost, questions are being asked. I think that's the most important, one of the most important things from this. Questions are finally being asked. women's ordination is being discussed. President Burton said, quote, We rejoice that we are privileged to live in this season of the history of the church when questions are being asked about the priesthood. There is a great interest and desire to know and understand more about the authority, power, and blessings associated with the priesthood of God, unquote. Second, church leaders are openly admitting that people are struggling with, or at least perplexed by, the question of why only men hold the priesthood. Many, like Elders Anderson, Ballard, and Sister Dew, admit that they ultimately don't know why men have the priesthood and women don't. In the October 2013 General Conference, Elder Neil L. Anderson answered the question, why are the ordinances of the priesthood administered by men? Citing 1 Nephi 11:17, quote, I do not know the meaning of all things, unquote. Elder M. Russell Ballard, speaking at BYU's 2013 Campus Education Week devotional, asked, why are men ordained to priesthood offices and not women? His answer, when all is said and done, the Lord has not revealed why. Similarly, Sherry Dew, in her book Women and the Priesthood, writes, why aren't women eligible for priesthood ordination? We don't know. Third, priesthood and men are not synonymous. Heretofore, priesthood was so associated with maleness that asking a Mormon woman if she wanted to be ordained was like asking her if she wanted to be a man. Church leaders, including Elders Anderson, Ballard, and Oaks, clearly state that, quote, men are not the priesthood. Uncoupling, I can't emphasize this enough, by the way, uncoupling priesthood from maleness and recognizing that it is a power that can be exercised by both men and women is an essential step in extending full priesthood authority to all worthy adult members of the church. Okay. Fourth, before Elder Oaks' priesthood session talk, some church leaders seem to be ditching the men have priesthood, women have motherhood parallel, which I think is good news. The bad news is they appear to be substituting other things for it. Men have priesthood, women have influence, for example. Whatever that means. Robert Kirby interpreted this to mean women have official permission to nag him. Don't we already? Oaks didn't mention motherhood with a capital M in his conference talk, but talked about women's ability to create new life as a counterpoint to men having priesthood. This, of course, is problematic. It ignores men's contribution to the creation of life and the fact that there's very little creativity in incubating. Cats do it, dogs do it, I did it. The creativity comes in parenting, which both men and women optimally share. Even Sherry Dew suggests she's not particularly fond of the priesthood-motherhood equation, which surprised me because if you remember her talk of 2002, where she talked about everyone, all women being mothers, whether or not you have children. Though there are a few holdouts, I'm hoping using motherhood to justify an all-male priesthood is on the wane. Unfortunately, separate but equal complementarian rhetoric, however, still holds sway. As President Burton noted, men and women, quote, have different complementary roles and are happy with that. Equality is an interesting term, she says. It doesn't always, I'm quoting from her, it doesn't always mean sameness, but we are of equal value. My response to that is, while it's true that equality isn't about sameness, it is about equal access and opportunity. Fifth, priesthood blessings, power, authority, office, and keys are being parsed and distinctions drawn in ways still shy of ordination for women, but that attempt to be more inclusive of women. Late 20th century church discourse responded to the women's movement primarily by asserting that both men and women enjoyed the blessings of the priesthood. But such attempts spawned rhetoric that occasionally bordered on the absurd. However, for example, Elder Bruce Hafen, speaking at the BYU Women's Conference in 1985, attempted to diffuse cries of gender inequity with the following. Quote, "The one, and I guess we are assumed to assume the only, category of blessing in which the role of woman is not the same as that of men holding the priesthood is that of administering the gospel and governing all things." A mere trifle. More recently, leaders have asserted that women can access both the blessings and the power of the priesthood. A number of you probably saw that video that came out soon after Ordained Women launched. And it was a couple of weeks before, actually, right after we launched the website and a couple of weeks before before we had the launch in Salt Lake. In that video of the three women presidents, does anyone know what I'm talking about? You saw it. Anyway, President Burton said, "I don't think women are after the authority. I think they're after the blessings and are happy that they can access the blessings and power of the priesthood. There are a few that would like both, but most of the women, I think, in the church are happy to have all the blessings." Okay? In her review of Dew's book, Valerie Hudson writes, quote, "Dew's greatest contribution in this book is her assertion that endowed women possess godly power or priesthood power. She begins with a statement by Elder Ballard that in the temple both men and women are endowed with the, quote, endowed with the same power, which by definition is priesthood power. This was reiterated in Dallin Oaks' April priesthood session talk. Dew goes on to state, and I'm again quoting from Hudson. Dew goes on to state that once endowed, a woman has, quoting Hudson, quoting Dew, direct access to priesthood power for her own life and responsibilities. Okay, so priesthood power, continuing with Dew, priesthood power is the power of God himself available to men and women alike who have been endowed in the house of the Lord. Men and women who are endowed in the house of the Lord have been given a gift of power, and they have been given a gift of knowledge to know how to access and use that power." Unquote. This, says Hudson, is really a very remarkable assertion. The formula has always been that women are the beneficiaries of priesthood power, and so only share it vicariously by being married to a man. But Dew is plainly saying that endowed women have been given priesthood power in the temple, which power they can use to benefit others. In other words, for the first time, it is being articulated that women are not simply passive recipients of divine power that has been coded male, but are able to hold and use divine power as agents without a male intermediary. As Dew puts it, both men and women would have full access to this heavenly power, though in different ways. Dew continues, "Women, unlike men, are not required to be ordained to the Melchizedek priesthood in order to enter the house of the Lord, though the ordinances performed there are all priesthood ordinances. Neither are women required to be ordained to the priesthood to serve as leaders in the Lord's church." Why is that the case, Dew asks. Now, and then Hudson asks, "Now, that's an interesting question to pose, isn't it? It's a question that is apparently a bridge too far for Dew, and she does not answer it in her book." Okay. Interestingly, a distinction is being made between the authority and the power of the priesthood. Authority and power traditionally have been associated with office. Isn't that your sense? I mean, if you think about it, I often, when I was growing up, authority and power seemed to be synonymous. Did some of you think that? I don't know. Anyway, but they're starting to draw interesting distinctions between or among all of these terms. So authority and power traditionally have been associated with office and thus available only to men. Power now seems to be available to all and is conditioned on righteousness. This is being said over and over and over again in the official church rhetoric, although it's not well developed. Okay, so in his April priesthood session talk, Elder Oaks went a step further and asserted that women not only enjoy the blessings and the power of the priesthood, they also exercise its authority in their callings. in the institutional church, quote, priesthood authority, and I'm going to quote from Oakes here, in the institutional church, priesthood authority is governed by priesthood holders who hold priesthood keys, and all that is done under the direction of those priesthood keys is done with priesthood authority. While women do not currently hold priesthood keys in office, Elder Oakes asserted that both women and men are recognized as having, quote, the authority of the priesthood in their church callings, unquote. He continued, and a long quote from him, "We are not accustomed to speaking of women having the authority of the priesthood in their church callings, but what other authority can it be?" And this, Oakes is echoing something that Elder Ballard had said earlier. Anyway, let's see. When a woman, again from Oakes, "When a woman, young or old, is set apart to preach the gospel as a full-time missionary, she is given priesthood authority to perform a priesthood function." Okay. The same is true when a woman is set apart to function as an officer, a teacher in a church organization under the direction of one who holds the keys of the priesthood. Whoever functions in an office or calling received from one who holds priesthood keys exercises priesthood authority in performing her or his assigned duties, unquote. Again, as with the power of the priesthood, we are still left scratching our heads and wondering what it means for women to exercise the authority of the priesthood in their callings. Can a Relief Society president, for example, bless the women over whom she presides by the authority of the holy priesthood, which she exercises by virtue of her calling? All of these are attempts to grapple with what I see as the fundamental inequity of an all-male priesthood. In the end, I believe they expose more than they satisfy. And let me end with an example of what I mean by exposing more than satisfying. Dew, in her book, devotes a lot of space to deflecting arguments for the ordination of women, particularly by emphasizing the powerful belief in our divine destiny and how empowering the knowledge is that we are gods in embryo. This knowledge, Dew writes, makes those of us who understand it, quote, think differently than those who don't. She then offers this, which is stunningly revealing, but probably not in the way Dew intends. Quote, "I know I'm a child of God and am special," a young single adult woman in Sydney, Australia said, adding, even if I'm nobody in this world. I thought that was a stunning quote from her book and spoke volumes. If women enjoy the blessings and exercise the power and the authority of the priesthood, why not office and keys?
No one's ever had trouble hearing me, so if that's the case, it's your fault, not mine. I'm supposed to be expressive. And mine will not be the most boring. I won't promise it will be the most exciting, but it will be the shortest of the ones that you hear up here. But first, all right. Follow me on Facebook. All right, so I'm Deborah Jensen. I'm here because I'm the chair of the Communications Committee for Ordained Women. I tend to write the first draft, and then it gets through three or four eagle eyes, and then Lori rewrites the whole thing of whatever we're going to write. And then I throw a fit, and then I don't usually know where we end up at the end. But it seems to be working so far. I have been asked to talk about the challenges of dealing with the church public relations department, which I'm sure won't get me in any trouble at all. Just to give you a little bit of an idea why I started with Ordained Women. The night that it launched, somebody who knows me sent me a link that said, "Have you seen this?" with like 8 question marks and exclamation points. And I went, no. And I looked at it and I thought, these people are crazy, but they're my kind of crazy. And so I immediately started writing my profile, and the next day, it was like 2 o'clock in the morning, the next day I sat my husband down and said, there's this thing and it's gonna get me in trouble, but I really wanna do it, what do you think? And he said, you should absolutely do this. So let's have a hand for the husbands in the room and the allies. So I would like, another contrast between Lori and me would be that she's been speaking about it for 30 years, and after my first initial query when I started coming to the LDS Church, I started attending when I was 12, so I could go to girls' camp, I tell everybody that. One of the first things I asked was why the boys that I went to school with were able to pass the sacrament and I was not. And after it, the first time I was shot down, I have whispered about it for 25 years. So I'm tired of whispering, and I'm just going to say in response to your whole, like their whole claim that we don't want power, I am a woman and I am not afraid to say, I want power. Like, if my son, when he was 11, was supposed to start training for and preparing for and desiring the power and authority of the priesthood, there is absolutely nothing wrong with me, the incubator, wanting it as well. So I make no apologies, and I want to do all the things where I sit and where I participate in ordinances, and I want to witness baptisms. I want to do those things. I want to minister and serve my faith community. I want to sit at the chair that makes decisions. I want to be around the table, and I don't want to be there because I've been invited because somebody thought at the last second that they need a uterus in the room. I want to be there because I am capable, and we belong at the table, and we belong making decisions. So that's my unofficial line. Lori talked about the official church discourse and how it's changed. My professional life, I am a professor at Utah State University. I have a PhD in communication, and I teach in public relations. So I'm going to talk to you about the challenge of trying to craft messages that are aimed at three different publics, but mostly just one. We at Ordained Women, every message we write has to be palatable to three specific groups. And that would be, first of all, true believing Mormons who are going to hear about this and hope to high heaven that they're not sitting next to one of us in Relief Society. We have to make ourselves acceptable to them. We're also aiming at the Church Public Affairs Department because, like it or not, this is the world we live in, and we have to go through them to get to our actual target audience, and that would be the 15 white guys in suits who we sustain and believe truthfully that the only way this change is going to happen is if they hear our request and ask the question. If we didn't believe that, if they weren't our target audience, we would just start ordaining each other higgledy-piggledy and doing what we feel like doing. So we have to make the message palatable, and we encounter three challenges that I can see with that. Two of them are official organizational challenges, and one of them is just one that I deal with personally and I feel like sharing. The first one would be we have to balance our language with being faithful, but also being aggressive, for lack of a better term. Clear. Assertive. There's nothing wrong with being aggressive. In a culture that thrives on passive-aggressive behavior, we are a group of women who are saying outright, blatantly, what we want. And when we're told no, we say, thank you. Here's what we're going to do. And we continue on our course. So trying to be faithful and non-aggressive, to be seen as those things while also remaining honest and firm, is a challenge, especially in a community and a culture where women are not generally allowed to be seen as firm in the face of authority. We also are dealing with a community that has a really screwed up definition of sustain. Like the idea that we can't pose questions and then when we're given an answer, if we don't like the answer, the sheer fact that we sent a second letter back to Church Public Affairs that said, cool, you didn't give us tickets, we'll still be there, just like we told you, is seen as radical. and disobedient, or as a Sunday school president or teacher put it to my son, inciting a mob at Temple Square. It was a great day. He went to church with his girlfriend, and this Sunday school teacher had, like, no idea who was sitting in his class. And she was talking about it, and he's all, yeah, my mom's one of those crazy ladies. She's actually not that bad. So in a land where we are passive-aggressive and do not allow women to participate at around the table and speak directly to power, we are trying to do that and still be seen as faithful, and it can be difficult. And it's also oftentimes is seen as causing contention. So we're trying to teach our fellow faithful members that sustaining does not mean obedience and constant support unfailingly, right? It means I recognize your position. I recognize that you are the person I have to go to with this. And if my personal revelation and personal beliefs jive with it, I'm going to do what you ask me to do. But I am entitled to say, this is what I want. And these cultural ideals die really hard. This is one of the biggest problems I have encountered is this idea that if someone who is in a priesthood leadership position above me, and they all are, gives me direction, I am disobedient if I fail to follow that direction, from wearing pants to church, to forcing my son to wear a white shirt to pass the sacrament, to lining up for tickets at Temple Square. These are all equivalent in their minds, and they all make me Martin Harris. True story. So faithful language has been very important, and trying to create a relationship or create a dialogue that includes faithful language but also firm language has been a challenge that we encounter. And sometimes we think we have hit it right on the head, right? This is maybe some inside baseball information, but it kills me every time we talk about it, okay? We thought when we made those six discussions, we were like, discussions, it's going to be so awesome, and people in our community will recognize this because this is what we do, right? We teach discussions, and it'll be great. And then apparently everyone who didn't sit around the table with us was like, oh, bad idea. I didn't go on a mission. All I know is that discussions is what we teach. We didn't make flip charts. I don't get what the big deal is, but it was a huge problem that we used that cultural language. We change it to conversations, and people are like, oh, cool. All right, whatever you say. So we have to be responsive to that and understand that maybe our feelings towards certain cultural ideas are not the same as conservative, I'm going to call them that because I'm not one, conservative Mormons. Second, we have to go through certain steps to speak with our leaders. Our request at its heart and soul is a call upon the Quorum of the 12 Apostles and the First Presidency of the Church to pray and search and ponder and pray again and ask this question and wait for an answer without a preconceived notion of what the answer should be. And this is not whatever year they were in Nauvoo. We cannot just march across the street and ask the prophet at the general store this question, which is where we get 98% of the Doctrine and Covenants from, right? We can't do that. We also, I'm pretty sure none of us is sleeping with the prophet like Emma was, because I get so many people who are like, oh, well, she did it right with the word of wisdom. Oh, great, how convenient. I don't know what to tell you with that. My husband is not going to get called to be a scout leader, let alone a bishop or the prophet, so I can't do that either. There are steps we have to go through, and right now, we have to go through church public affairs. We go through them, we request our meetings. We go through them, we request our tickets. We go through them to request just about anything, and they one time, twice, have like responded directly to us and engaged in non-official letterhead conversation. And man, I was like so excited, you guys, you don't even know. Ruth Todd's caller ID, like came up on my caller ID, and I was like, shut up! Are you kidding me? And it was great for that first couple of weeks when I thought for sure Ruth Todd was going to go and she was going to schedule us a meeting. It was going to be great. It was going to be awesome. We were going to get in there and I'd be ordained by Christmas. But public affairs, their job is to protect the institution. And I recognize that. I teach students how to do that every day. Our job is to try to break down that barrier and get to the people who make the decisions. And it's been, there's an inevitable conflict because our attempts to reach out are seen as we're seen as being salacious, we're seen as being media whores. I'm just going to say it. If I had a nickel for every time somebody said to me, well, if you guys would just do this privately, you're making the church look bad in public. You go to the news. Why does Kate Kelly go to the news with her excommunication? Well, first of all, because it is news. And second, because her stake president kind of told her he was going to do it if she didn't. So you want to write your own story, right? So we have to go through the public eye in order to have these conversations pushed to the forefront. And I think as Lori's demonstrated, and as the fact that I can watch the priesthood session online in October, but I'm probably not going to do it there. I'm probably going to go somewhere else to do it. The fact that I can do that now, I would say, is evidence that our public campaign has been successful, not completely, but we're getting there. So using media to engage with our target audience is difficult when there's a barrier between them. When they just won't engage in conversation with us anymore. It's what they do. Okay. I want to say one other thing about that. We've also encountered some pushback about doing this on social media, and I'm not really sure how to answer that, except it exists, I'm going to use it. Like, that's the way it is. You don't like it, that's fine. Travel back in time 35 years, and we can do a letter-writing campaign. But right now, we're going to do it on social media. We're going to use Facebook, we're going to use Twitter, and we're going to try to gather people. And as far as I'm concerned, although we celebrate every milestone, likes, visits, blog hits, profile counts, we celebrate those milestones, but that number does not matter as much as the conversations that are being generated and the responses that we are getting, although indirectly. Although it was pretty cool when we got a statement from the first presidency. That was kind of awesome. How many of you have done that? All right, sorry. Okay, so this, I'm going to talk personally about the third challenge that I see. On April 5th, I sat next to my grandma is 82, and she's Mormon, like 18 generations back Mormon. She's an actual literal daughter of Utah pioneers. She goes to meetings every month. She's the woman that took me to church when I was 12, and she's the woman that took me through the temple when I was endowed in 1996. She's my only familial connection to Mormonism. And I went to visit her the day after we were at Temple Square. And she was terribly concerned that I got to get this right because I wrote it down, that I had participated in a riot on Temple Square, making it a place of protest by staging a demonstration and refusing to accept ushers' requests and refusing to leave when asked. She got all of this from the church's official statement about what happened in April. And I looked at her, and I am a robot who does not feel things, and I lost it. I just started crying. And I said, you know me. I am inappropriate in like 19 other ways, but I would not do that. You know me. And I explained to her what really happened. I said, we went. We were quiet and peaceful. We stood in a line. And you know what? No one once asked me to leave. And I never heard anyone ask anyone in our group to leave. The usher at the door said, you're welcome here, as they sneaked men around the corner. It's not really a corner because it's an oval building, but you get the idea, right? And she was shocked. I honestly think a part of her broke that day when I told her that what had been released publicly was not what I had seen and participated in, and she really has struggled to reconcile the story that I told her with the story she was given by the church. And I understand, again, that this is the challenge of dealing with public affairs, right? Their job is to describe any group more than, that's larger than five people as a mob or as a riot. I get that. But it has been incredibly painful for me as someone who would never actually start a riot on Temple Square, as someone who really struggled with the fact that my church was equating me with protesters who hold up pictures of aborted fetuses while people are trying to walk to a worship session. That's hard. And I think it's very hard for everyone else that I go to church with. I know it is. I know it is. My bishop has sat across his desk from me and explained to me exactly all the things I've been doing wrong, and they are ripped from the headlines. It's like Law and Order, LDS. They are like exactly what is coming out of the church public affairs office. So when we talk about the challenge of doing this, it's not only the challenge of reaching them, but trying to get our story out. Nationally, it's been okay. We've done pretty good. We've actually done a really great job. Our story is usually the first one that goes out nationally. But here locally, where the vast majority of Mormons seem to reside, it's been more challenging, and I think that's because public affairs has access to some pretty powerful media agents. You know who they are, right? And so that's been hard for us to try to create a balance so that people understand who we actually are. And we're still working on it. Thank you.
So speaking of who has the most boring, mine is about numbers. So here we go. I am going to be talking about retention effort and how that's been affected with the Oh, sorry. I'm Amy Isaacson Cartwright, and I serve on the leadership of Ordained Women. I'm like way underneath these ladies, so a little bit of, you know, fangirling. But I'm going to be talking about retention, Ordained Women as retention effort, and how that's been affected by Kate Kelly's excommunication. And before I launch into that, this is a really, actually really personal topic for me, because that's actually what got me involved in Ordained Women. I had been visiting with one of my personal Mormon matriarchs, and she had always been the epitome of the perfect LDS woman in my mind. Growing up, her husband served in high leadership callings, just a very prominent figure in my mind. And I started seeing her pop up in things like Feminist Mormon Housewives and the Mormon Hub, and I'm like, this is interesting. And I had a visit with her, actually about a year ago. It was just after Ordained Women had launched. And I came to find out that she had more or less discontinued activity in the church. And while it was historical issues that had brought that to the forefront, it was gender exclusion that was kind of the ongoing painful issue for her. And that was that moment when I had already been following Ordained Women and had kind of, it's not really my fight. I don't have any huge desires for priesthood personally. And I had kind of decided that that would be somebody else's fight. And as we were talking, I was sharing that it was really painful for me to see these things and to hear the reasonings given for not ordaining women because they just seemed asinine. And so while I didn't personally desire priesthood, I was really concerned by the reasons why women were not ordained. And she said to me, "You know, Amy, things are getting better. They're slowly but surely getting better." And within me was this huge cry that said, "You are in your 60s. They will not get better fast enough for you." And we focus a lot on the millennials, especially because that's the most active group, I would suggest, in Ordained Women. Yeah, about 25 to 35. But my personal concern was actually for my Mormon matriarchs, because I thought, I don't want you to die without seeing women being ordained. I want you to see this happen. So I will add my voice. And I did. And it's been a very life-changing experience. And, you know, that's another talk. My great desire also was that I felt that, and I would say this was my primary desire, I could see that women were largely leaving the church for faith reasons, but also because they felt that they could not raise their concerns, that if they did, they received censure. And that led me to believe that the greatest thing that is needed to keep women in the church who want to stay is a safe space in which to raise these concerns, not just in private groups, not just in hushed voices, but that they can proclaim that this is something that matters to them, and that whether or not women are ordained, they are allowed to say that they want to be ordained. And so I believe that that will be the greatest tool that the church could employ to keep women in the church who want to stay, is to at least allow the conversation with peace and without malice. And so as you can imagine, when the accusations come that ordained women is leading people out of the church and that we're leading people away from the gospel and all this stuff, I want to cry. No, that for me was actually the primary motivation. I would even say that personally being ordained is secondary to allowing the opportunity for my sisters, if they want to stay in the church, to be able to stay, to feel that they have a space where they can publicly state what they feel. And when the news of Kate Kelly's impending disciplinary council when that news was released, we had people submit letters, and a large majority of those letters, once you weeded out the crazies that also submit letters, but a large majority of those letters said, Kate Kelly, ordained women, helped me to find a place where I could stay. They helped me to find a place where I was safe. I'm just going to read a few of those letters. Thanks to Kate Kelly, I was able to see that one can simultaneously have a strong testimony of the gospel and hope for improvement within the organization of the church. That is not apostasy. Kate Kelly and other people like her gave me examples of faithful members who share my concerns, which helps me heal my broken testimony. Ordained women has helped me become more spiritual and thoughtful about doctrine than I have ever been during my entire life as a Mormon. I have done more studying, more praying, more pondering, and more fellowshipping. I have become closer to my husband through thoughtful conversations. I have become closer to God, knowing that he loves his daughters and has given them many talents to serve others. Another letter. Ordained women has inspired me and helped me recommit to Mormonism over the last 2 years. I am an active Mormon gospel doctrine teacher who struggles with issues of gender inequality in the church, and ordained women has given my faith and my testimony new energy. With the advent of ordained women, I had new reason to hope that there was room in the church to seek, knock, and ask regarding difficult questions about gender. These are things that Jesus instructs us to do, and my faith and testimony have been built by these women's willingness to ask our church leaders to think about women's roles and the possibility for more expansive opportunities for women. I am now more committed to the church than I have been in years, in large part because ordained women gave me hope that there was room for a variety of Mormons in the church. Ordained women helped me to see the expansive potential of the church, that it is growing robust and long-sighted enough to accommodate various ideological commitments. And there are a number more, but I'm going to skip over those. And one thing that we also saw in these letters is this ending of this dichotomy that one could not be a faithful member of the church and believe that women could be ordained. I believe that until ordained women, and probably still within a lot of Mormon circles, that's a belief that you cannot be a faithful, believing member of the church and desire women's ordination. And ordained women has helped to negotiate this space, largely thanks to our very fantastic statements that are trying to balance all of those needs. But I also believe because that we have a number of very believing, orthodox belief women who are submitting profiles who say, no, I believe that women should be ordained. And so it's helping to expose that false dichotomy, which I believe will be very helpful. Now, following the excommunication of Kate Kelly, we did see a shift in the Mormon feminist and progressive Mormon community. Well, before, a number of women and men had suggested the existence and, to that point, lack of formal censure of ordained women and its most prominent leader had helped them to feel they had a place in the church. We are now seeing that many are choosing to voluntarily limit their activity as a result of the church's statements and involvement in, we don't know how much involvement, but we can presume how much involvement church headquarters had in that, in the excommunication of Kate Kelly. So we sent out a survey to the Mormon feminist and progressive Mormon groups just this last week, asking them to identify their activity rate in May before the news of the impending disciplinary council, and then their activity now in July after Kate Kelly had been excommunicated. And let's see here. I have fancy. And what we saw was pretty disheartening. We saw a fairly large decline in those who attended weekly as a result of the excommunication, largely because of the excommunication. We saw there was a 16% drop in the number of women who attended church weekly between May and July. So we asked women, do you attend church weekly? Or almost weekly? Do you attend 2 to 3 times a month? Do you attend approximately once a month, or do you not attend at all? And 55% of the women who we surveyed said that they did attend weekly in May before the excommunication. After that point, 39%, with an anticipated 1% drop in December. Some people are holding on for specific reasons, but another 1% plan to drop in December. For men that we surveyed, 60% of men were attending weekly in May. In July, we're now finding that 48% of men are attending weekly with another anticipated 1% drop. We also saw an increase in those who do not attend at all. When we surveyed them, 24% of women said that they did not attend at all in May. In July, it was 31%. In May, we saw 22% of men who suggested they did not attend at all, and that jumped to 30% of the men in July. Now, there were obviously other reasons when we asked people to state the most cited reason for the drop in activity rate was a general faith crisis, and combined with the excommunication of Kate Kelly and the threatened discipline against John Dillon. Other reasons cited were feelings of distrust after the Book of Abraham essay was released by the church, frustration with church PR department for speaking instead of leaders, as well as what characterized statements as being dishonest. And then other political matters, such as the same-sex marriage ruling in Utah and the church's response to Hobby Lobby, etc. But again, the most common reason that was cited for a drop in attendance was the excommunication of Kate Kelly. In their responses, people said, Kate Kelly's excommunication was the impetus for for change. Kate Kelly broke no covenants and committed no sin, but was excommunicated by an all-male leadership for advocating for women's equality. I have no voice in my church. The men are in control and have made it clear that women's voices do not matter. Another woman wrote, the excommunication of Kate Kelly sent a strong message that women of faith and intelligence are not wanted in the LDS Church. I realized my assumptions about the kindness and goodwill of church leaders and other members was naive and erroneous. I now perceive the LDS Church as abusive and as an impediment to a stronger relationship with Jesus Christ and heavenly parents. I'm just not sure yet if I love the patriarchal evil traditions I've been raised in more than I love Christ. Change is hard, and I'm very interested in my identity as a Mormon. I feel like the abused wife who won't quit her man. The excommunication of Kate Kelly and ensuing disciplinary actions against other Mormon feminists has made me fearful and has made me feel unwanted as myself. Lastly, I thought if they don't want them, then they don't want me, has run through my head many, many times. I feel that there isn't a place in the church for a person like me. I really felt like that last response best captures the overall feeling that has been communicated in online groups about the excommunication, is this Social media has opened up a way for the lines between personhood to kind of be blurred, that what goes on in your life I can experience in real time, and what goes on in my life you can experience in real time. And in a lot of ways, people felt that the excommunication of Kate Kelly was almost an excommunication of themselves. And that's something that is a reality of social media, and is something that I think the church has really not anticipated well, that instead of people backing off because of Kate Kelly's excommunication, instead they had felt that they had been personally wounded as well. And I believe from reading through the letters pre-excommunication and post-excommunication that the greatest gesture the church could extend to women who desire to continue activity in the church is to allow for a space where it is safe to state that one wants to be ordained rather than receiving censure and discipline. Thank you.
Okay, my name is Nancy Ross, and I'm the chair of social media for Ordained Women. I'm also a professor, an assistant professor of art history at Dixie State University. And my talk really follows on from some of the things that Amy was talking about. We kind of did this little survey and gathered this information together, and we were really focusing on activity rates and trying to find out, wanting people to state in their own terms, you know, what's happening with their activity, not only between May of this year and July of this year, but what do they anticipate in the future? Do they anticipate recovering activity that is lost? And asking them about the reasons for these different changes. And as I was reading through the responses, this was just a snowball survey, so again, our statistics aren't generally, we can't generalize them to the whole of the Mormon feminist community, though they do give us some kind of barometer reading of what is happening at the moment. We had about, let's see, I think it's ongoing, but we had about 521 responses. And I was really surprised by the data, even though I had anticipated some of it. And I was especially interested in the numbers that that Amy relayed with, you know, what happens at the top end with regard to activity, and then what happens at the bottom end with regard to activity. But one thing that really came up quite a lot in the survey was this idea of resignation, as in formally resigning from the church, and that's something that I don't want to talk about briefly. In the last year, I've surveyed the Mormon feminist community about 8 times, and the first time I did it was a year ago in July of 2013, and Jessica Finnegan and I surveyed the whole of Mormon feminism, or at least we tried to as much as we could. We had 1,862 responses, and we were beyond thrilled with the way in which Mormon feminists really wanted to tell their stories, especially to people doing research on Mormon feminism. And when we did that survey, resignation hardly appeared at all. It wasn't really a blip on our radar when we read through all of the data. It wasn't something that people were talking about in the forums. It wasn't something that people were talking about in blogs. We've written a paper about our survey last summer, and we're kind of hoping that it's going to be published by Dialogue at some point. But in that survey that we did, of the 1,862 individuals who responded, just 2 referenced resignation. They both were women, both stated that they had resigned previously, and seemed to indicate that the church's involvement with Prop 8 was pretty much the main reason for their resignation. But no one stated in the survey that they were considering resigning, and only the 2 really referenced it at all. And so it didn't really, it wasn't on my radar for something to look for and something to be listening for. And of course, if you participate in Mormon feminism online or in progressive Mormonism online, you will have noticed the flurry of resignation letters that people have been posting on Facebook. And I'm not sure that that was something that I fully anticipated. And when we did the survey, I was surprised to see how frequently it came up. And so we did this survey, it's just this last week, 521 responses, and of those 521, 27 referenced resignation, which is a lot more than 2 out of more than 1,800. Just three men referenced resignation, whereas 23 women referenced it, and one gender nonconforming individual also referenced it. Of those who referenced resignation, 11 reported that they were considering resignation, and 5 indicated that they had resigned between May and June, of July, rather, of this year. One person reported that she wanted to resign but couldn't because of family reasons. And the remaining individuals had already resigned at some point prior to May of this year. And then I went a little bit further to look at those 11 who were considering resignation. Of the 11, 10 of them were already not attending church, okay, and reported that in May they were not attending church. But one in May, that last one, so 10 of the 11 were not attending church in May, but one of them reported that they were attending church every week in May. And that one, I realize, seems very small. That's just one person. But then when we try to say, okay, well, that's just one in a relatively small sample, and it's not a random sample, et cetera, et cetera. But how many does that one represent in our community? How many people were fully active and fully participating in May and are now considering resigning, now considering completely severing their relationship with the church? And that is more than a little bit distressing for me. I'm active, and I really am committed to staying active, and that is an extremely difficult thing for me at the moment. Someone in my ward recently emailed everyone else in my ward telling them, warning them of the dangers of me. And that was really hard, especially as I consider myself a fairly boring person. Like, really? Okay, and so when Amy told me that she wanted to do a survey about activity rates, I really wanted to pull the brakes on it and say, no, we can't do this right now, because now is not representative of our community, and the numbers are going to look so bad. In the sense of, you know, I feel that I represent, at least in part, and within Ordained Women, people who are trying to make activity in the church work, and I didn't want to do Amy's idea. So instead of letting her do it on my own, I took it over. So, because I figured then at least I'd have a good sense of what was happening in the survey. And I was really worried, because I believe, as Amy said, I believe that Mormon feminism and participation in Mormon feminism online helps people to negotiate their relationship with the church in a way that is comfortable them, and for many, many individuals helps them to stay. Okay? This is something I believe. This is something that many people who participate in Mormon feminism, in whatever camp they participate in, you know, this is something that is really important to us, for those of us who see this. So I said before that I'd surveyed the Mormon feminist community a number of times, and in every survey I've conducted previously, I've seen that 70-something percent of Mormon feminists report that they attend church at least 2 to 3 times per month. And to see those numbers drop dramatically by more than 10 points, and again, in a non-random survey, so it's not generalizable, but it's still very distressing to me, because when people talk to me outside of Mormon feminism, and they ask me why on earth I'm involved in Ordained Women, and I try to explain the benefits of participating in Mormon feminism for many individuals, this is the first thing I go to. This helps people stay active. If people are struggling in the church, they find a support community online, and the support community helps them to negotiate whatever kind of relationship they want with the church. And that is a benefit. That's certainly been a benefit to me. I'm not sure if I would still be active in the way that I am without Mormon feminism, without all the women who have made this and ordained possible, ordained women possible. And I've read the Book of Mormon 23 times, people. Like, I'm not a slacker Mormon. I consider myself like faithful and committed. I love all of you slacker Mormons. But I'm just saying this idea of the reduction in activity rates is deeply distressing to me. And so I want to go back to this question of how can I still justify that Mormon feminism helps people stay active when we see the numbers falling? You know, and that's a difficult question to answer. And the way that I want to kind of present this, and again, I'm not using data for this, but this is my hypothesis, is that the Mormon feminist community can only absorb so much difficulty. It can only absorb so much sexism, and it can only absorb so much persecution. And what we saw with Kate Kelly in June is that the church maxed out our ability to support people in the way that they need support. And that's very upsetting, because this is the church that I love. And so I just want to kind of throw this out there, to kind of talk about resignation. We've all seen it. You know, if you've been online, you've seen it happening. You've seen all of these different groups. And so where do we go from here, in the words of Buffy the Vampire Slayer in the musical episode? And I think what's going to happen in the next year is that Mormon feminism, first of all, the church is in the process of change, and we've all seen this. This is happening. Even though the church is trying to retain its very conservative position, as Lori very clearly outlined, the church is wrestling with women in the priesthood and trying to frame it differently without necessarily making changes. At some point, it's going to run out of framing options, and we're going to just have to make change. But at the same time, where do we go from here? And I guess one thing I wonder is, the Mormon feminist community of the next year, is it going to be able to adapt and change to better support individuals who are trying to make it work? And are we going to see new groups or even new shifts to try and help individuals negotiate new and difficult situations, and not just the ongoing sexism that many of us experience? And so I don't really have a good answer for that at the moment, but I think that it will. I think that we will grow and change. Just as the church is growing and changing and shifting right now, our Mormon feminist community will also grow and change and shift to better support those who are trying not only to participate in Mormon feminism, but also trying to make their church activity work for them as well. And that's kind of all that I've got at the moment, but thank you very much.
Hello, good afternoon. Okay, we'll try to make this quick so we can get to some question and answers. You can see real quick why the board is so diverse and how different we are and why it takes us so long to make decisions and write letters, okay? Because we all are coming at it from a completely different perspective. So I'm in charge of strategic planning and operations, which basically means like herding 500 people around at every event and planning what we should do, when we should do, and how we should do it. So I do want to, I'm going to start a little bit kind of updating you on, well, where is Ordained Women going from now? And then I'm going to talk a little bit as I take off my Ordained Women hat and my Mormon feminist hat and put on my anthropologist hat. And we're going to talk a little bit about culture and the kind of reframing of collective identity that's happening right now in Mormonism and why. And I want to leave you with some poignant questions, and then we'll get to a question and answer. So it'll be real quick. Where are we going? We're not going anywhere.
Forward.
We have the exact same goals, we have the exact same objective, we have the exact same people, and we're willing to move forward. And if you want to know specifics, we ask you to join our group. We have jobs for you. There's lots of stuff we need to do, and there's cool stuff we're working on, but you don't get to know that. Unless you join us, okay? Because we're very strategic, right? So it's a short synopsis. I know you want details, but really where we want to stand is just kind of stand firmly where we are in a space that we've created, which is faithful activism, direct activism, being assertive with what we want and unapologetic, and feeling like saying I want this is not insubordinate and it's not disobedient. It's having self-respect, right? Yep. So that's exactly where we are, you know, 6 months ago at the last Sunstone. That's exactly where we are today. But I think there's some questions that need to be asked. And Lori always asks this question, and I think it's really, Lori always says this statement, and I love it. She says, it's 2014. I don't think what we're asking is very radical. You know, a bunch of nice women in nice clothes waiting politely in line and saying, can you maybe please pray about something for us? Because we believe you have the authority. I mean, that's not a radical statement. So this is what I want to leave you with, is this question kind of in your mind. if you think that what Ordained Women is doing is radical, then you have sorely misunderstood Mormon cultural history. Right? Even you have a short memory. We're talking even 40 years ago, we were chaining ourselves to stuff, right? We were throwing, flying planes over conference. If you think that what Ordained Women is doing, you are not looking at our history. And I want us to think about that. Everyone, real quick, I want to say, what happened to Mormon feminism before Kate Kelly? Raise your hand. No, stand up right now if you've participated in progressive Mormonism or Mormon feminism pre-2013. Okay. Look around. We've been here. I'm looking at some of my friends here. We've been here. We've been doing this kind of stuff. I took Kate Kelly to her first feminist conference 3 years ago. We've been doing this. We've been asking these questions. So there is no pre-post, except for something changed. And I think this is where we're going to get into some fascinating cultural discussions, and then I'll open it up to questions. I want you to think about that question. Why is what's happening radical now? And I want to just read something that I wrote, because I won't say it as well. I said, when we tried to do it politely, when we tried to do it respectfully and with deference, we were ignored. In other words, when we filled the role that had been created and taught to us our entire lives, no surprise, we were treated the way we had been treated our entire lives. Which is to be, and this is a Jennifer Finlayson Fife quote, surprise, which is that women are the support staff to the real work of men, right? So we can influence on the pillow at night. We can informally assert our stewardship, but at every level it can be trumped. And so what we're doing is not radical, and yet it's revolutionary. And I want us to go back to Emma Smith. I want us to go back to the Revolution. I want us to go back to DNC 25. It's 25, right? 125. I know, Nance. How many times have you read the DNC?
Not so much. I'm not such a
good You can go pray about this revelation, but if you get an answer that is not mine, you are damned to hell. And this is what's revolutionary about what we're doing. Okay? Is that women's ability to claim their inspiration has been through an intermediary, which is a male. That I can only receive inspiration in so much that my next highest leader accepts. So as a Relief Society president, I can claim stewardship. I believe, I can pray, I can get revelation. But if my leader says, well, no, I want to call someone else in that position, my inspiration is invalid. And it goes all the way up the chain. And we have some wonderful quotes from Chieko Okazaki and from Eileen Clyde about this, right? About receiving revelation for your stewardship, but having it trumped. And why, so what we're doing is not radical, but why it's revolutionary is we're breaking outside of the cultural code and the cultural script that all of us have been living in and accepting for so many years. And we're saying, my revelation is not trumped. I feel that women should have, not feel, I know, that women should have ecclesiastical and administrative decision-making power. Okay. And to move forward with that unapologetically and in a way that we aren't used to. And that's the revolutionary thing here. And that's what's making people feel uncomfortable, right? Again, we can get back and we can talk. I want to leave some time for questions, but I could talk at length and explain to you about early church history that people are saying, well, if you don't do exactly what the brethren say, which is kind of abstract and confusing anyway, but if you don't do exactly what they say, then you're not sustaining them. Okay, again, a complete misreading of how the church works, okay? Early church history, people said no to Joseph Smith regularly. Women, the founding of the Relief Society. We have a story right here, I think it's Lori, of Brigham Young specifically asking a woman something and her throwing coffee in his face. Okay, these are prophets. Coffee. But back then, coffee was okay. See, the church changes. And I'm bringing these historical moments up to just explain to you a little bit about culture. That culture is this beautiful thing, and we feel protected, and we feel connected to one another, and we feel like we have a community. But it also creates these limits by which we feel like we're allowed and not allowed to act. And what the culture was back then is, I can love Joseph. I can love Brigham. And yes, they called them by their first names. And I can sustain them, and I can believe in them. But I can say no to them. And I can say I disagree with them. And to disagree is not to be insubordinate or disobedient, right? And what we've done over the last 100 years, and I can give you all those reasons maybe another time, of why our culture has changed in the manner that it has, but what we currently have is a very heavy patriarchal structure in which, if we aren't not only giving the honorific before the person's name and thinking every single thing they do is ordained and is given authority by directly from our Heavenly Father, then we're being insubordinate, right? And that's not actually the early church. That's not actually the way that the church was structured. I don't know, we could talk about early church versus now later, but I just want everyone to kind of take a second to think about that. Why, and have that be in your brains today, is why is what's happening today being seen as radical, and what does that tell us about our culture? And what does that tell us about strategic moves we can make in the ways that we communicate and ask and talk and speak and present ourselves that break through that cultural script, right? And I'm going to end with one caveat. The caveat is there are consequences to breaking that script, okay? And we've seen those consequences, and they're very painful. Every single person on this panel has received hate mail. I get it weekly. Okay, every one of us has been ostracized by a ward, has been let go of callings, has been not called to something, our kids have not been allowed to play with others. We have received absolute, as an anthropologist, and I think Natasha Helfer Parker will say, absolute social ostracism and rejection for our participation. So there's consequences. But there's also something that we need to talk about just real quickly, which is there's a generational problem. Because the people leading the church are of a generation where the thing that is the most important is loyalty, respect, obedience. Don't air your dirty laundry in front of other people, right? If you speak out against leaders, that's being disloyal to your country. That's being disloyal to your people, right? And then we have another generation of the blogger knackle that's coming out of transparency. We've seen historical figures really do bad stuff. We can see our whole history. We don't believe you. You don't get respect until you prove it. So respect is earned. Loyalty is earned. Transparency is valued. Authenticity is valued. So we have these two generations clashing at a time when they're miscommunicating. We want to know how you pray to God and receive revelation. And if you've asked, and they're saying, you should believe us because I said so. Do you understand? And they're saying, you're not respecting us. They're feeling threatened. You're not respecting us the way that they have been taught that respect is valued. And we're saying, but you're not showing us that we can respect you. And so we're having a generational clash right here. And it's not just in Mormonism. It's across America. But that clash is not going to get better by each side continuing with valuing the things that they value and not understanding why the other side is feeling attacked and hurt. So it is this... As we move forward and try to break the cultural script that keeps women silent, because the experience of being a woman in a religion is to be silent, as we break that cultural script with all of our interfaith sisters throughout the world in the next 50 years, which I think will be the biggest revolution that happens in the next 50 years, is religious gender equality, there's going to be consequences, and there's going to be ways we can do it better or worse. And I just want us to keep those in mind as we move forward. I think we do want to open it up. About 10 minutes of questions, so let me preface this, because we all know how Sunstone is. If you have a brilliant, genius, pithy question, come on up. And if we have more specific questions, we have different committees and subheadings, some people in charge of action, some people in charge of social media and profiles, etc. what we can do is afterwards kind of hook you up with that committee chair and get you to, you know, maybe you have a great idea for a future action. So come up to us after the main session about specifics like that, and we will get you in line with the person that can really affect that change. Okay? Okay, I'm moderating these questions. Now everyone's scared? Come on. Break the cultural script. Is that one on so we can just transfer?
I think so.
Okay. Yo, it's on.
This?
Here, try this one.
I can do that.
It's for the recording.
My question for all of you, I apologize, is somewhat pessimistic, but I'm wondering, do you have a breaking point? Because for me, I was in grad school in 1993, writing about Mormon feminism, and I couldn't stay. I couldn't, because I was sure I was next, and I didn't want that. And so I've been apart for the church for a really long time, and I admire what you are all doing, and I think it's fantastic, but do you have a personal breaking point?
Well, this gets into a lot of conversation that we Mormons say, that's a really, really spiritual experience, but I have had I felt a very personal calling to remain in the church. So my breaking point that I decided was that they would have to stare me down and tell me that I had to leave. That would be my breaking point.
I have probably hit my breaking point at least 6 times and announced publicly to members of my family and my neighbors that I'm never going back to church. And then every Saturday night I think, oh, hell no, I am not letting them keep me out of my chapel. I have vacuumed that chapel a million times and I will sit in it. My breaking point is probably close to what yours is. I have a 16-year-old son and an almost 12-year-old daughter, so girls camp may be the breaking point for me next year, depending on what she comes home sounding like. And I have an 8-year-old daughter. I'll keep going until my kids beg me to stop because it's too hard for them. And it's gotten really hard for them. It's gotten really hard for them. Or I'll keep going until when I pray, the answer is don't go back. I'm not asking you to do that much. Not that I'm doing a whole lot by just sitting there in my pants, but I'm clearly agitating someone.
I have two answers to that, like a personal and a professional. So my personal one is, I don't want to belittle like the pain and damage like that I've experienced, but it's also been a decade. So I'm like, I feel like I'm a little tougher now. So if I was being my tough self, I would say there is no breaking point. I'm Mormon. I always will be. I always have been. It doesn't matter if you think I'm Mormon. It doesn't matter if they think I'm Mormon. It doesn't matter if they stare me down and tell me I'm not Mormon. I'm Mormon. So, I mean, there is no breaking point. You can tell me I don't believe the right way or dress the right way or think the right way. Okay, I don't care. You know, I think you think weird things too. Whatever. I can't make you not human. So we are what we are, right? So, I mean, that's my answer is, you know, as I go through these transformations in life, I am sure I will be at different levels of activity, and I'm sure I'll be at different levels of activism, and I'm sure there's going to be times I need to take a break. But through all of that, I think Mormonism will always be who I am in one way or another. The professional answer is I do think it is very difficult to leave a primary social group. It is enormously painful, especially if it's not just social. If it's also cultural, which means that it's like the way you patterned your paradigm and thinking, that's almost impossible to uproot your entire foundation. There's nearly nothing as painful and difficult as to change your entire worldview. Why the breaking point might be different nowadays is that we have a community to go to. And I think that's what these two were trying to bring up, which was in the past, if you were excommunicated in the past, which we need to do a clap for these women who have gone through that. In the past, if you were experiencing a lot of this pain, you didn't have sisters you could talk to on a daily basis who could show up at your house in local communities. You didn't have these connections constantly. So why it's easier to have either a longer breaking point or a middle period is because we have these other communities to go into that we don't feel like we're losing our entire social and our entire worldview.
You mentioned surprise and distress at the resignations that have happened. I'm one who chose to resign as a result of this, and I was a church employee for 17 and a half years, was the technical lead of the team that runs the membership system. But I also had an abusive husband who used the language of the temple against me, and I had gone through all the rules, written letters saying, requesting President Hinckley to seek revelation to know if that was really necessary. That language that was used to abuse. And for me, seeing the reaction to ordained women, I chose to leave because it made it very, very clear that they weren't going to hear me. And so what I'm wondering, though, is if... Thank you. I'm wondering if, though, the resignations may help your cause when, if the church leaders can see you will lose women who have consecrated their lives to this if you do not change. Maybe that'll help your cause.
I think one, you know, the church often trots out its membership number as one of the most important things about it to prove growth, even though, you know, we really know that not that many people are active. We don't have 15 million church members who are active. And I think that one of the things that is happening right now is that a lot of people are resigning, and that's probably not going to stop immediately. That's probably going to go on for a while, and that's going to really eat into perhaps decreased missionary baptisms as well. And so there is a sense that what's happening right now may in fact affect the church's bottom line, which is numbers. I think that's the church's bottom line. There might be a bunch of bottom lines or other ones that I'm not aware of. But I think that there may very well be an effect of what excommunicating Kate Kelly this summer is going to have a far-reaching effect. One of those effects is resignations, and that really eats into the church's core mission of having more and more people be involved with it at least a little bit, or at least on the books. And so I think that's definitely going to continue to affect the church. My guess is that by the time they realize that this is or could be a big problem, that the time for doing something about it is long past.
I also think that, again, it goes back to, I gotta say, this internet changed everything. Because what we see is the same people making these decisions made the decision about Sonia Johnson. And they made the decision in 1993, and they made the decision in 2003. So I think in the past, if you have 40 years of experience telling you that, oh, something scary is happening, get rid of the rotten apple, and then everything will go away, okay, the people who are troubled will, like, resign, right? So there's the issue of, oh, they'll be affected by the numbers. There's the issue of, well, okay, then they'll resign, and then we can get back to, like, boundary maintenance. But what's different is there's this really big misunderstanding of what the internet is. So I don't think it's going to be the same in 2014 that it was the past four decades. And so that's going to change everything, that by getting rid of a few, it's not going to silence people the way that it has in the past. It's not going to cause fear in the way that it has, because we do have a community.
And I would just add to that as well, what we've seen with ordained women is a huge increase in the number of people who are willing to join with us by submitting profiles, and that we've had more than, I think, 200 profiles submitted since Kate Kelly was excommunicated. And we've been posting lots of profiles. We've slowed down just a little bit, and only we've been posting them in order that we've received them, and we're now just getting to the beginning of July. So, like,
Right, and we're very close to 500 now. We're very, you know, in the next week or two. And so what we've seen is exactly what Chelsea had said, which is that the internet causes a different response because nobody's going underground. Nobody's going away this time. The critical voices stay the same.
Sorry. I will say, I think I agree that the internet is changing it and that officially they're going to see some pushback, and it may help the case. It may have made us stronger what I think is going to happen is you see more informal punishment for people at the local level. I think you're going to see it's going to be much harder for those people because they're not going to be public about excommunicating people. I'd be very surprised to see 8 more come down the pipeline, although maybe it's me, who knows? Maybe it's you. But I'd be very surprised to see anything public that they can make a story out of. What I wouldn't be surprised about and what we've heard is not so much resignations, but I can't have a calling anymore. Or every Girl Scout in my Girl Scout troop who's in my ward is no longer allowed to come to Girl Scouts, which is probably what their dad wanted anyway. But like those kinds of informal social challenges are going to be much higher.
The other thing that's been exposed in all of this, I think, too, is the, I don't know what the right word is, maybe the arbitrariness of it, the sort of leader roulette that we're going through in terms of church discipline, whereas in one area, people can speak quite openly. They have, in Boston, for example, the state presidency called meetings and said, let's talk about these issues, and let's, feel free to ask questions and express your concerns. In other areas of the country, women are being silenced. So that's a problem the church, I think, is going to have to grapple with. Okay. I guess it's time to stop it. Before we go, we'd like to talk to you about our next action. Last year, we launched with an interfaith action with our sisters co-sponsored by our Catholic sisters. It's called Equal in Faith, and it's Women Fast for Gender Justice in Religion. This year, we decided that the date, remember the date, August 26th, because it's going to be a regional, we're going to sponsor regional meet, greets, and organize. Meetings with our Catholic sisters and women of other faiths for a major Equal in Faith event on during the March, which is International Women's Month, and it'll be on March 8th where we'll sponsor another large Equal in Faith event that we hope will involve many communities of women in faith, because in many ways, as I think that Chelsea said, religion, in many ways, unfortunately, is the last bastion of acceptable discrimination. And it's time for that to change because, as Jimmy Carter and any number of other people have pointed out, religion can be used to either liberate or subjugate. What will we choose? What will we choose? And with that, keep look up on our website and see how you can get involved in our Equal in Faith event. Anything else?